Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight we bring you part two of our special holiday broadcast of readings from the 2003 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism held earlier this month in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Writers and journalists from across the nation gathered at the conference to read from their reporting. Each story intimately conveys the reality we see and the reality that we sometimes don't. Tonight we'll hear a story about second-generation immigrants in the South working at an all-American institution, the local Dairy Queen, a story about a married couple's negotiation over household chores, and a story about early days of the Rwandan genocide. Tonight on Point, stories from the narrative journalism front lines, some gritty, some funny, all real. We begin tonight with a reading by independent broadcast journalist Jay Allison, four-time Peabody Award winner and executive director of Atlantic Public Media. Here he reads from an essay he wrote for the New York Times magazine entitled, How Sweet the Sound.
I ride an old motorcycle. It breaks down regularly, and the guy who used to do the repair work went bankrupt and left town. I called around, and the only place willing to do the work now is a chopper shop about an hour away where the local motorcycle gangs get their bikes fixed. The inside of the shop is black. Everything is black. Tires, grease, the owner's beard. The windows are painted over, and light comes from flickering fluorescence. Old glass cases that might once have displayed candy in a general store now hold metal objects for sale, oversized pistons, knives, heavy belt buckles. Calendars hang on every dark wall. Anywhere you look, you can see what day it is and at the same time see a girl in a bikini bent over a chopper looking back at you. The owner is behind a display case. With my eyes still adjusting to the dim light, it's hard to make him out clearly. He asks me what I want, as if I'm in there by mistake. And I tell him I called earlier and explain what I need. And as I talk, a strange thing happens. My voice falls inexorably lower, becomes tight and flat, some version of manly. My usual syntax changes as I bend my sentences away from complex construction and in the bending make them even more awkward than they might have been without the effort behind them. I swear liberally and drop the G's and my ING's, and when I stop talking, I keep my molars pressed together and grind them almost as if I'm chewing gum. I don't try to do this, I just do. I can't help myself. Standing in the darkened room, I feel like a male dog, seemingly nonchalant, but indicating my capacity for aggressiveness while consciously containing it. In fact, the shop has a dog that's been moving slowly toward me as I talk. It's a bitch, and that's what the owner calls her. That's her name, he says. She's a sad-looking cocker spaniel, made mean by meanness, and moves as if to snap at me. I step sideways. Get back, bitch, says the owner. And the dog retreats to her greasy sleeping pad. A shaft of light cuts into the shop, and when the outside door opens and my wife and 2-year-old daughter appear, they're tired of playing outside. I am stunned by their incongruity in this room. I pick my daughter up off the black floor. Hi, sweetie, I say. The words sweetie and my tone of voice are suddenly not at all gruff. They sound together like piano notes. Just as my voice assumes a life of its own while talking to the owner of the chopper shop, it will not obey me in talking to my daughter. I can only be tender with her. For a moment, I have dropped my persona. It's as though I've been found out or found myself out. Amid the choppers with their airbrush paint jobs, gas tanks shaped like women's bodies, flashy chrome straight pipes, extended front ends, hardtail rears, I am holding my little girl. I hand her back to my wife. I have to wheel my motorcycle into the garage out back, and the owner and I walk together. He flings his Budweiser can into a pile of cans in the dirt and yells at the dog some more. I notice tattoos on the pale flesh of his arm, a knife in his skull, a panther, and the double-winged Harley-Davidson insignia. The sight of it takes me back. About 15 years ago, and 50 miles from here, I was walking on the beach with some friends when we were caught in a sudden and violent storm. The surf was breaking hard from 100 yards offshore, and right in the middle was a little pleasure boat rolling from side to side like a toy. We could see three heavy set guys in the stern holding on. In the slow motion that sudden events appear to take, the boat heaved hard in one direction and then capsized smoothly in the other when a big wave pushed it over. The men in the stern went into the ocean. The first thing I did was take off my shoes. I shouldn't have. The barnacled rocks would cut up my feet. But I was 23 years old, and that's what I heard you should do. Without thinking about it, I ran into the water, scrambled out over the rocks, and swam through the surf toward the men. I saw my friend off to the right doing the same thing. The girls we were with waited on the beach and watched. The first guy we reached was dead. We didn't realize it right off. I didn't know someone could drown so fast. We dragged him out of the shore and began mouth-to-mouth on him. His face was blue, and his mouth was foamy. His eyes were empty, and he stank of beer, and he was dead. Leaving him on the beach, I turned back into the ocean to go for another guy who was clinging to a rock about 60 yards out. By the time I reached him, he was losing his grip. He was 20 years older than I, outweighed me by 75 pounds, and was almost unconscious from drink and shock. I pulled him into my arms and carried him through the surf, bullying his body over the rocks. His big bearded face was pale and helpless. On his upper arm was a tattoo, Harley Davidson. Dragging him along, both of us bleeding and exhausted, I spoke to him constantly. I heard myself saying to him over and over, "It's okay, baby. It's going to be okay. You're going to be all right, my baby." I kept calling him that, tenderly, over and over, until we stumbled onto the shore and the girls took him from me. "And when are you going to pick this up?" I'm jerked back into the moment, let my guard down, and the owner of the chopper shop is looking at me sideways. I answer him, "Just call me when it's ready. That'll be fine." My words come out plainly, without an edge. Having nothing else to say, I leave. When I get out front, I pull my daughter up into my arms. Holding her high in the air, I shake her a little, and she laughs. I do too. Together, our voices sound sweet and intense, effortless, immaculate. Thank you.
Independent broadcast journalist Jay Allison reading from an essay he wrote for the New York Times Magazine. Next up is Ann Hull, enterprise reporter for The Washington Post. Tonight, Ann Hull reads a story from Rim of the New World, her series on second-generation immigrants in the American South, about working at a local Dairy Queen.
The Dairy Queen glows in the night, a beacon of Americana. But inside, chaos descends. 12 customers are waiting at the front counter, and the drive-through lane is a snake of headlights, the voices over the drive-through speaker unrelenting. "I want caramel on the bottom of that mudslide. A lot of caramel, you hear? One chicken value meal with a Mr. Pibb. And let me see, 3 value meals. And could you cut all the burgers in quarters? Do you have supersized drinks or is large the biggest y'all got?" Cisco Montañez is 15 years old and working the drive-through window. His Dairy Queen hat is cocked on his head like a tilted ornament. His khakis circus big. He is half Latino and half black, so he has plenty of reason to glare at the Confederate flag moving toward him on the GMC Suburban. Cisco turns his back on the Confederate flag and reaches for a plastic banana split boat. As he fills it with 3 puffs of vanilla ice cream, he begins to rap. "This life hurts. No cushion for me, no carpet laid out. We either sell or we're getting sold." The Indian immigrants who work at Dairy Queen have no idea what Cisco's talking about. He raps all night long, breathless incantations about injustice, pistols, and housing projects. The Indians are mystified by a brain that fires out couplets but won't do schoolwork. "He don't use his brain in the right way," says Ali Momin, the 22-year-old assistant manager. Ali presses the drive-through speaker and greets the customers with his musical Indian accent. "Welcome to Dairy Queen. May I check your order, please?" Long pause and then a southern drawl. "Do what now?" This little Dairy Queen, the walls decorated with plaques of all-white t-ball teams from another era, an employee named Miss Carroll, hired back before the world changed, wears a Jesus Cares pin on her uniform, while her Muslim supervisor cooks his food in a crock pot separate from the other Dairy Queen food. The franchise owner, an Indian, swings by in his Porsche to check on receipts. And Cisco, at the drive-thru, ranting about race, 6 miles from a tourist spot called the Gone with the Wind Historical District. The Dairy Queen on State Road 138 has been visited by a global awakening, all beneath a soft-serve ice cream cone. As Cisco says in one of his night's chants, tomorrow is right now. The Dairy Queen is 14 miles southeast of Hartsfield-Atlanta International Airport, just inside Clayton County. Not long ago, Clayton County was pastures and okra stands. Then, like the rest of the suburban South, it exploded in the 1990s with a 30% population growth and the sound of bulldozers moving across red clay. The proof is in the exit ramp civilizations that cling to the pilings of the interstates below. Waffle House, Taco Bell, Holiday Inn Express, Quick Trip, all in endless repetition. But it's here in this numbing sameness, amid the heat lamps and sparkly stucco plazas, that a racial and ethnic fusion has taken hold. This is the new soul of the South. Immigrants from Mexico, India, South Korea, Vietnam, and other countries shocked a fundamentally white and black society. This first generation poured in for work, and to survive, many of them sweated on the margins of one of the most prosperous chapters in the American economy. Now their children are coming of age with different expectations of what a life can be. They may live in cramped apartments with parents who speak no English and earn $7 an hour, but their own yearnings have been stoked by Nike Town. They are testing every institution in their path, in schools that are unprepared to teach them, in a place that has no context for immigration, and in a part of the country historically hostile to anyone not white. A Dairy Queen hardly seems like a staging ground for the future. The store in Stockbridge, Georgia, looks like any other. On sunny days, the red sign creaks in the wind. Car exhaust from the road blows up on the patio tables. At night, the white-lit building glows luminous and cold. Half the crew is Indian or Pakistani. In their blue polo shirts, they work as if each sale brings a handsome commission instead of low wages in the grubby trenches of the American economy. How about a Blizzard Chocolate Extreme, Fazana Khan suggests in her Urdu-inflected English. It's full of delicious cocoa fudge. You like chocolate, right, ma'am? We are selling lots of these today. Next customer. Just give me a kid's chicken fingers. Farzana presses the drive-through microphone button. What sauce, ma'am? We have all kinds delicious. White gravy? This kind of zeal boggles the minds of the American employees, most of whom are the sons and daughters of the working class, still in high school, or as one 16-year-old employee explains it, I'm homeschooling myself. Cisco Montañez works the drive-through window. The average fast food worker in America quits or is fired after 4 months, but Cisco has 9 months at the Dairy Queen. He's supposed to be in the eighth grade, but he never went back after a suspension. Somehow this Dairy Queen holds him. He is rarely late for work. I like ice cream, he shrugs. His mother is Puerto Rican. She left the Bronx with her 2 kids when Cisco was 4 because she thought the South would be a gentler experience for her kids. Now Cisco is completely black identified. He tells his mom to use the word sausage and not chorizo. One evening, Cisco takes his dinner break on the DQ patio. He eats his fries and lights a cigarette, pocketing his chicken sandwich for later. From the patio table, Cisco can almost make out the skyscrapers of Atlanta. Atlanta means Lenox Square Mall and the clubs of Buckhead, where rappers like Pastor Troy and the other so-so deaf recording artists go to chill. Once, when Cisco was working, Jermaine Dupri came through the Dairy Queen drive-thru and ordered a cone with sprinkles. He had a big white Beamer with a peanut butter dash, Cisco remembers. But Cisco's world is closer to the Dairy Queen. This next exit is my exit, he says, and the exit after that is my cousin's exit. His mother, grandmother bring him to work. He gets out of the car with his red Nautica shorts peeking out of his khakis as he does his little walk into the Dairy Queen. Sometimes, Cisco sees the owner arriving in his Infiniti. A subdued car like that just makes Cisco shake his head in pity. He let all that money go to waste. Thank you.
Anne Hull reading from her series, Rim of the New World, featured in the Washington Post. We'll hear more readings in just a moment. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to writers reading their own works of narrative journalism. Next, we'll hear Mark Kramer, an author and director of the Nieman Program on Narrative Journalism. Here he reads an excerpt from an unfinished book he's writing on being an older father. In this passage, Mark Kramer reminisces about his then 4-year-old son, Will, at play.
Will, who's 4, knows more about the bewildering world than he usually does whenever he starts up a game. His second favorite play just now is wrestling with me. He goes from standing by to grappling my leg and grinning in a moment, from waiting to engaged, a hunting kitten. He has unconventional views on what constitutes winning a wrestling match. Mid-grapple, he often smiles up at me and says, "Who won?" He's doped out that games have objects, but not what the object is. As he does, something will be lost. The meaning of a game without set purpose, a game for playing, not winning, is plastic. He tests himself. Can he get my arm down, down, down there? Can he wriggle free of my grip? Can he run past me without getting snagged and flipped upside down, as has happened to delighted shrieks the past 3 passes he's tried? Oops, missed. He can. He picks play, at which he's competent. "Daddy, can we flip?" he asks. I hold his hands. He walks up my legs until his back parallels the floor. He walks upward 1 step further, pushes off, and his feet whirl over his head. I turn my hands outward so I don't break his wrists. He nails a perfect 10 landing and shouts, "Again, again," and we do, and we do, and we do, and we do, and he never stops loving it. He defies gravity stylishly. It was his first trick, and it's still a good one. If there were a giant around, I'd try it too. His new favorite's batting. Will won't take a father's counsel on much, but he's raptly accepted help with batting skills. It's his first disciplined desire. Out across the lawn, which is just greening up with the start of the ball season, standing in front of a chewed-up old home plate, the scale of bat and ball remind me that Will is still tiny. The gods have granted him his mom's family's fine coordination. He insists on a useful batting stance. He's a bat length away from the far edge of the plate, turned sideways, elbows up, bat head back over but not touching his shoulder. His knees are bent. He tracks the pitch all the way in. He swings torso, torquing without moving his head. He hits liners up the middle. His timing is astounding. He shouts with glee, and then he does something joyful and illogical to this grown-up, hit-hungry, last-picked non-player. Were I up there with my dad pitching into my sweet spot, I'd forget the running and just bat and bat. But Will drops the bat after every hit and skids off around a tree at the far side of the yard, slows and watches for me to chase him. He doesn't yet care if I first field the ball. I must chase. He gets mad if I do too good a job and actually catch him, and also if I fail to make a pretty good effort. He does not tire of winning under these circumstances and won't be caught without scolding me. "Dad, it's a home run. You don't catch me." I don't catch him, but I do chase. I'm not, he is telling me, a playmate vying for possession of the plate. He's conferred on me a flattering higher status. Actor in his dream of triumph, competence, excellence, being as good as or identical to Nomar. My part is, let's pretend you almost catch Nomar and don't. Once I figured this out, Nomar and I got along very well. Kids take years readying to make friends. Parallel play transforms into companionship very slowly. They slide toward interchange. I'm dad, and more obliging than 4-year-olds. Will can direct me as a producer does, fit me to his fantasies of how the play should go. In a few years, the real rules of baseball will replace his many versions. The object will have come clear, and he'll play with friends, all consenting to the rules, not to the dream of one player. Then he'll know who won. Rules, and rule for that matter, crawl right up from the innocent pleasures of play. For now, ad hoc rules carry over to our game of circus. I am ringmaster for his act. Next up, for your viewing pleasure, ladies and gentlemen of the circus audience, here in the center ring and straight from the pampas of Argentina is Wild Willing Will and his astounding magnificent coffee table leap. I drum. He leaps, writhing like a teen daredevil cannonballing into a pool. He slides into green pillows, not water, and does it again. Next time he surprises me, aims at me by the pillows and not at the pillows. He's inventing a rule. I must catch him every time he leaps off the coffee table at me. I must not even reach for him when he elects to leap directly to the pillows. If I don't comply, he trains me some more. No, catch me. And he says, it's a rule when I resist and try to add a trick. He's learned the melody of impatience to help with the training. Dad, I'm his, and he's my star. I'm programmable, usefully so. His play's so urgent that he cries with frustration if his game is declined or upset or refined. We adults dismissively tell kids, go play. But that turns out to be like telling them, go climb Mount Everest, slay a dragon, and invent a spaceship. It's not a suggestion to keep things light, not for Will. Heroism is hard work, being the strongest, fastest, most terrific. He starts with the extremes he comprehends. He can't yet be simply quite good at batting. Who's the best athlete on our street, Will? I ask between pitches. A boy down the street is miraculously good, sought by kids 3 or 4 years older to fill out their teams. I am, says Will. Isn't Anders an amazing hitter? No. Yesterday, Will sent the ball right over the fence and flashed a thrilled face and ran around and batted again and hit another and ran around. The first law of preschool thermodynamics, a kid in ecstatic motion wants to stay in ecstatic motion. He wants to keep the game going, stay where the game rules apply. Between wrestling holds, between pitches, he speaks with charged voice. Game Will, not regular Will, a little stiff-lipped, flashing a mischievous smile, presumably about his verbal delivery, because the smile sure doesn't go with the content, which is often dire, as in, I'm going to eat you all up, or I'm the big star, the score is 41-3. No, you've got 4.
Mark Kramer is writer in residence at the Nieman Foundation at Harvard University and director of the Nieman Program on Narrative Journalism. Adam Hochschild is an author, co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Here he reads from a piece for the San Francisco Chronicle, spoofing the Bush administration's dogged pursuit of privatization.
Following the Bush administration's recent proposals to privatize parts of Amtrak and to transfer to private contractors thousands of federal jobs in national parks, air traffic control towers, and elsewhere, the White House has announced its latest candidate for privatization, air. The public has been getting a free ride here for too long, said presidential political strategist Karl Rove. The idea that air is something you don't have to pay for is a remnant of Democrat free spending, tax and spend days. Free air is costing American industry billions in lost opportunities. And when industry profits, the economy grows and we all benefit. A senior White House official speaking not for attribution added, it's only those latte-sipping liberals who think there's always a free lunch or a free breath. The president's plan envisions the genius of private enterprise taking over the task of selling breathing permits. Volume discounts would be available for the military, for corporations wanting to offer the permits as a perk for employees, for Bible colleges and similar educational institutions. But Mr. Bush brushed aside any suggestion of discounting the price of breathing permits for lower-income people. As with food, housing, and so much else, Bush said yesterday, I think there's a key role here for faith-based initiatives. Let the churches step in to help. The Halliburton Company has already been granted a license to sell the first 30 million breathing permits. Unavailable at an undisclosed location yesterday, Vice President Dick Cheney declined all comment about whether plans for air privatization had been discussed during his tenure as Halliburton's CEO. A spokesperson of his said, the vice president has only the best interests of all Americans at heart. An early wrinkle in the plan, insiders said, had been how to overcome the obstacle posed by the fact that the nation's air supply, unlike most other privatization targets, had not previously been owned by the federal government. This problem was solved by adopting a model followed by the biotech industry, patenting. Mr. Rove's office disclosed that the patent on the basic air molecule is now owned by Enron BioEther Partnerships, a unit of the Enron Corporation spun off just before the parent company's bankruptcy. Challenges to the American patent are expected to come from other countries via the World Trade Organization. It's the old Europe again, the unnamed White House senior official said. In response to the president's bill, congressional Democrats have put forth their own air privatization measure. We're willing to work with the president on this, a spokesman for Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle said. We just think he may be going too far, too fast. He announced the introduction of the rival Daschle-Lieberman Act, which would leave the nitrogen and carbon dioxide components of air at least temporarily in the public realm while privatizing only the oxygen. Thank you.
Adam Hochschild is an author and co-founder of Mother Jones magazine. He teaches writing at the University of California, Berkeley. Samantha Power is a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and founding executive director of the school's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Tonight she reads an excerpt about the Rwandan genocide from her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide.
Many of the early Tutsi victims found themselves specifically and not spontaneously pursued. A survivor of a massacre at a hospital in Kubuya reported that he had heard a list read over a loudspeaker before the attack began. Another survivor said that once the killing was finished, in his words, quote, they sent people in among the bodies to verify who was dead. They said, here's the treasurer and his wife and daughter, but where is the younger child? Or here is Joshua's father, his wife and mother, but where is he? And then in the days after, they tried to hunt you down if they thought you were still alive. They would shout out, hey, Joshua, we see you now, to make you jump and try to run so that they could see you move and get you more easily. Because the Hutu and the Tutsi had lived intermingled and in many instances intermarried, the outbreak of killing forced Hutu and Tutsi friends and relatives into life-altering decisions about whether or not to desert their loved ones in order to save their own lives. At Muganero Church in the town of Kubuya, two Hutu sisters, each married to a Tutsi husband, faced such a choice. One of the women decided to die with her husband. The other, who hoped to save the lives of her 11 children, chose to leave. Because her husband was a Tutsi, her children had been categorized as Tutsi and thus were technically forbidden to live. But the machete-wielding Hutu attackers had assured the woman that the children would be permitted to depart safely if she agreed to accompany them. When the woman stepped out of the church, though, she saw the assailants butcher 8 of the 11 children. The youngest, a child of 3 years old, pleaded for his life after seeing his brothers and sisters slain. Please don't kill me, he said. I'll never be Tutsi again. But the killers, unblinking, struck him down. David Rawson, the U.S. ambassador to Rwanda, was sitting with his wife in their residence watching a tape broadcast of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour when he heard the back-to-back explosions that signaled the downing of the Rwandan president's plane. As the U.S. ambassador, Rawson was concerned primarily for American citizens, whom he feared would be killed or injured in any outbreak of fighting. The United States made the decision to withdraw its personnel and nationals from Rwanda on April 7, the following day. Penned within his house, Rawson didn't think his presence was of any use. Looking back, he says, "Did we have a moral responsibility to stay there? Would it have made a difference? I don't know, but the killings were taking place in broad daylight while we were there. I didn't feel like we were achieving much." Still, about 300 Rwandans from the neighborhood had gathered at Rawson's residence seeking refuge, and when the Americans cleared out, the local people were left to their fates. Rawson recalls, I told the people who were there that we were leaving and that the flag was coming down and that they would have to make their own choice about what to do. Nobody really asked us to take them with us. Rawson says he couldn't help even those who worked closest to him. His chief steward, who served dinner and washed dishes, called the ambassador from his home and pleaded, "We're in terrible danger. Please, come and get us." Rawson says, I had to tell him, we can't move. We can't come. The steward and his wife were killed hours later. Prudence Bushnell was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She was put in charge of a task force to manage the evacuation of the Americans. Her focus was on U.S. citizens. I felt very strongly that my first obligation was to the Americans. I was sorry about the Rwandans, of course, but my job was to get our folks out. Then again, she said, people didn't know then that it was a genocide. What I was told was, look, Prudence, these people do this from time to time. These people do this from time to time. We thought we'd be right back. At a State Department press conference on April 8, 2 days after the beginning of the genocide, Bushnell made an appearance and spoke gravely about the mounting violence in Rwanda and the status, of course, of the Americans. After she left the podium, Michael McCurry, the department spokesman, took her place and, without missing a beat, began criticizing foreign governments for preventing the screening of the Steven Spielberg film Schindler's List. This film movingly portrays the 20th century's most horrible catastrophe, McCurry said, and it shows that even in the midst of genocide, one individual can make a difference. McCurry urged that the film be shown worldwide. He said, the most effective way to avoid the recurrence of genocidal tragedy is to ensure that past acts of genocide are never forgotten. No one made any connection between Bushnell's remarks and McCurry's. Neither journalists nor officials in the United States were focused on the Tutsi. On April 9 and 10, in five different convoys, Ambassador Rawson and 250 Americans were evacuated from Kigali and other points. When we left, Rawson says, the cars were stopped and searched. It would have been impossible to get Tutsi out. All told, 35 local employees of the U.S. Embassy were killed in the genocide. Thank you.
Samantha Power reading from her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. More readings after a short break. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're hearing from some of the country's best writers, reading from their works at the 2003 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Next we'll hear from author Arlie Hochschild, reading from her book, The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home, about the complex negotiations of a married couple dividing the household chores.
One evening in the fifth year of their marriage, Nancy Holt first seriously raised the issue with Evan. I told him, "Look, Evan, it's not working. I do the housework, I take major care of Joey, and I work a full-time job. I get pissed. This is your house, too. Joey is your child, too. It's not all my job to care for them. When I cooled down, I put it to him. Look, how about this? I'll cook Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. You cook Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and we'll share or go out Sundays. According to Nancy, Evan said he didn't like rigid schedules. He said he didn't necessarily agree with her standards of housekeeping and didn't like that standard imposed on him, especially if she was sloughing off tasks on him, which from time to time he felt she was. But he went along with the idea in principle. Nancy said the first week of the new plan went as follows. On Monday, she cooked. For Tuesday, Evan planned a meal that required shopping for a few ingredients, but on his way home, he forgot to shop for them. He came home, saw nothing he could use in the refrigerator or in the cupboard, and suggested to Nancy that they go out for Chinese. On Wednesday, Nancy cooked. On Thursday, Nancy reminded Evan, "Tonight it's your turn." That night, Evan fixed hamburgers and French fries, and Nancy was quick to praise him. On Friday, Nancy cooked. On Saturday, Evan forgot again. As this pattern continued, Nancy's reminders became sharper. The sharper they became, the more actively Evan forgot, perhaps anticipating ever sharper reprimands if he resisted more directly. And this cycle of passive refusal, followed by disappointment and anger, gradually tightened. And before long, the struggle had spread to the task of doing the laundry. Nancy said it was only fair that Evan share the laundry. He agreed in principle, but anxious that Evan would not share, Nancy wanted a clear, explicit agreement. "You ought to wash and fold every other load," she told him. Evan experienced this plan as a yoke around his neck. And on many work days at this point, a huge pile of laundry sat like a disheveled guest on the living room couch. Not long after this crisis in the Holtz marriage, there was a dramatic lessening of tension over the issue of the second shift. It was as if the issue was closed. Evan had won. Nancy would do the second shift. Evan expressed vague guilt, but beyond that, he had nothing to say. Nancy had wearied of continually raising the topic, wearied of the lack of resolution. Now, in the exhaustion of defeat, she wanted the struggle to be over, too. Evan was so good in other ways. Why debilitate their marriage by continual quarreling? Besides, she told me, don't women always adjust more? One day, when I asked Nancy to tell me who did which tasks from a long list of household chores, she interrupted me with a broad wave of the hand. "I do the upstairs. Evan does the downstairs." Now, what did that mean, I asked. Matter-of-factly, she explained that the upstairs included the living room, the dining room, the kitchen, the two bedrooms, and two baths. The downstairs meant the garage, a place for storage and hobbies, Evan's hobbies. She explained this as a sharing arrangement without humor or irony, just as Evan did later. Both said they had agreed it was the best solution to their dispute. Evan would take care of the car, the garage, and Max, the family dog. As Nancy explained, the dog is all Evan's problem. "I don't have to deal with the dog." Nancy took care of the rest. For purposes of accommodating the second shift, then, the Holtz garage was elevated to the full moral and practical equivalent of the rest of the house. For Nancy and Evan, upstairs and downstairs, inside and outside, was vaguely described like half and half, a fair division of labor based on a natural division of the house. The problem they felt had been fixed, at least until it sprang another leak. Thank you.
Arlie Hochschild reading from her book, The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home. close tonight with Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University and columnist for The Nation magazine. She reads from a forthcoming book tentatively titled Room Service.
My Uncle Carl was a food chemist. He made many contributions to the betterment of civilization. He developed a process that ultimately allowed powdered sugar to be made in a commercially efficient manner, and he spent years seeking a way to cheaply desalinate water. But perhaps his most enduring gift to humankind was in the field of food preservatives. If you see any comestible with a shelf life of 25 years, you can just bet Uncle Carl had a hand in it. He was a good man and a brilliant one with many honors and awards. His only flaw and greatest conceit was that he fancied himself a cook. One often hears it said that cooking is just chemistry, perhaps. But Uncle Carl was living proof that chemistry is not cooking. Growing up with him meant having to sample a range of molecularly sustaining but horrifically unappetizing recipes made by reviving things normal people would bury. Or had buried, but that Uncle Carl had dug up. And I shouldn't overstate. Really, he only skimmed from the top of the compost heap. Now, once home from one of these little expeditions to the backs of various grocery stores, collecting discards, vegetables whose resuscitation lay at the frontiers of science, Uncle Carl would lay out the bounty on a marble slab, hack out the worst of the rot, and begin a process he thought of as resurrection, but to the rational observer more closely resembled embalming. By the time they made it to the table, his concoctions always lay on the plate in a state of unnatural polish, their color a bit too bright, like excessively rouged corpses. I have French friends whose parents taught them to taste along a meticulous and nuanced spectrum of flavors, aromas, and freshness. Uncle Carl taught us the same thing, if you drop out the concept of freshness. I have a nose for alpha tocopherol. I am the rare individual who can distinguish a monosodium glutamate from a disodium guanylate. It was destiny, I suppose, that my life is fueled by flash-frozen, reconstituted, and ready-made food. My principal role model, my kind and intelligent mother, had little in common with Martha Stewart. I have no fresh-from-the-oven mother-daughter recollections, only the daily creaking of cans being opened and the sucking sounds of gelatinous vegetables splurting from their tin-encased vacuums. Her kitchen was filled with smoke and impatience. How deeply my mother believed in the conveniences of the 1950s, almost as a kind of political freedom. How grateful she was for boxed mixes, canned soups, Jiffy Pop, instant rice, and homemade ice cream. You didn't have to make at home. My mother was as happy to have been born in a time of TV dinners and washing machines as I am to have come along in time for cell phones and laptop computers. And so I grew up finding my own path, frying what could not be boiled, winging my life through without recipes. One Independence Day not long ago, I was invited to a party to celebrate pluralism and the great diversity of us, the American people. "Bring an hors d'oeuvre representing your ethnic heritage," said the hostess, innocently enough. And I was stumped. Now, in addition to my mother, I grew up right here in Boston. Historically, Boston's regional cuisine, well, there is a reason they call it Beantown. And my mother's cooking was relentlessly steeped in New England traditions of hard winter cuisine. One of the earliest memories my sister and I share is that of my mother borrowing my father's screwdriver so she could pry open a box of salt cod. In those days, cod came in wooden boxes, nailed shut, and you really had to hack around the edges to loosen the lid. Cod from a box had to be soaked overnight, and the next day you mixed it with boiled potatoes and fried it out in Crisco. And that's how my mother described it, frying it out, with those unconscious little telling prepositions. She'd always be frying something up or out. And then whatever it was, she would serve it with baked beans on the side in a little brown pot with salt pork and molasses. We'd have baked chicken on Sundays, otherwise boiled. My mother has actual recipes for boiling chicken, a whole range of them, with and without bay leaf, onions, potatoes, carrots, or not. Life can never be dull with boiled chicken. These were the staples of my mother's home cooking. Now, the truth is we also liked watermelon in my family, all of us. But the only times we ate it, well, those were secret moments, private moments, guilty, even shameful moments, never unburdened by the thought of what would happen if our white neighbors saw us enjoying the primevally, stereotypically black fruit. We were always on display when it came to things stereotypical. And fortunately, my mother was never handier in the kitchen than when under political pressure. She would take that odd, thin-necked implement known as a melon baller and gouge out innocent pink circlets and serve them to us like little mounds of faux sorbet in fluted crystal goblets. The only time we used those goblets, they were wedding gifts, was to disguise watermelon in case someone was peering through the windows, lurking about in racial judgment, albeit for lack of better things to do. I suppose it's unusual. Virtually none of the women in my family truly invested themselves in the kitchen. I don't remember my mother baking a cake even once. Perhaps I'm romanticizing again, but I think it was because my mother grew up among a lot of determined African-American women who were just plain tired of cooking, and she was among the first generation in any kind of position to break out of the mold, cook and nanny, and she took that mold breaking as a kind of mission. As a parent, I suppose I'm very much like my mother. I am my mother's daughter, well-educated, independent, and a half-hearted, intermittent boiler-up of chickens. Luckily, my kitchen has a phone in it with a million little menus from places like the Fast Macrobiotic Wok stacked next to it. I have a few cans of peas and a couple of frozen dinners for home cooking's sake, but the unfortunate truth is that my globalized ready-serve version of Uncle Carl's legacy has already shaped my son's childish imagination. One day when he was 2, he volunteered to help me make dinner. "By all means," I said in grateful wonderment. He ran to the phone and picked it up. "Room service, please," he demanded. Now that he's a bit older, my son dreams of his own future house, a vision heavily inflected by lifestyles of rich and famous superheroes. He longs for a paintball range, a basketball court, dogs he is wildly allergic to, and a kitchen full of vending machines that dispense eel sushi and orangina. In real life, my son and I sit having a snack of cinnamon toast with lovely big mugs of steamed milk. I'm explaining to him that Chippendale is a very finely crafted line of furniture, and he is just as earnestly explaining to me that Chip and Dale are a couple of chipmunks who rescue creatures larger than they through clever detective work. We argue until it's time for him to go to bed. I tuck him in. "Sweet dreams," I say. "We are playing house. We make ourselves at home." Thank you.
Patricia Williams is professor of law at Columbia University and columnist for The Nation magazine. We've been sharing readings tonight from the 2003 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Special thanks to Mark Kramer at the Nieman Foundation and to Buck Ewing at Cambridge Transcriptions. For more information about the Nieman Conference or to listen to the readings we've shared, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.